Hi, and welcome to the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, that has a mission to inform people with cancer about the many benefits of integrative medicine and to help them access them. This show is just one of the ways we do this, and if you want to know more, then I do encourage you to take a look at yestolife.org.uk. Today, I'm diving into the mysterious world of Qigong. In my experience, it's one of those disciplines that you get very different descriptions of depending on who you ask. Today, I'm fortunate to be speaking to someone with over two decades of experience working with the practice and extensive experience of helping people with cancer. I'm talking to John Miller over the internet in East Anglia. Hi, John. Thanks so much for coming on the Yes to Life show.
Well, thanks for having me.
So I'm sure there'll be people out there whose response to hearing about Qigong would be, well, what? Another type of Eastern exercise with a weird name? What's wrong with going to the gym? So could you tell us what you think Qigong brings to us that we might not find at the gym, and what sets it apart from all the other panoply of Eastern disciplines, Tai Chi, yoga, all the rest, that have arrived in recent decades?
I would dearly love to say nothing, because I think the truth of the matter is, it doesn't matter what the exercise form you use is, you can find great benefit in it.
Right.
But it depends on how it works, really. And for me, the thing that attracts me to Qigong and has meant that I've sort of dedicated myself to the practice is the ability for it to work with the body and mind connection really, really strongly and really cleanly. Mm. The intention that sits within it is always it's always around healing or around self-cultivation, unless you go off and do the wushu, which is the sort of martial aspects of it.
Okay.
So, I guess my answer has to be, unfortunately, not an awful lot. It is about choosing the flavor of therapy that works best for you, and Qigong just happens to work best for me.
Right, okay. And obviously it works for some other people too, otherwise you'd be doing it on your own. So Michael Lerner, he was one of the pioneers of a more holistic approach to cancer care, working in the US. He raved about the benefits of Qigong for those with cancer in his groundbreaking book called Choices in Healing. This was way back in the 20th century. Qigong's not really an obvious go-to for most people with cancer, even many of those already embracing integrative medicine, I think. So just imagine I'm someone recently diagnosed, I know nothing about Qigong, and you've got the opportunity to tell me all about it. What would you have to say?
It really starts with what your expectations are. The people that we've worked with over the years, some of them will come to us and they are wanting Qigong to be the answer. There was a center in China called the Huajia Center, and it had a great reputation. It had over 400,000 people go through. Wow. With significant diagnosis. And so the particular form of Qigong that I practice, Xineng Qigong, got this great reputation about its work with cancer.
Right.
So if people have come in through that route, quite often they are looking for the complete approach, the complete answer.
Right.
And so this is one way that we will work with people. But then there's a whole range of sort of ways that you can work, all the way down to the situation where somebody is referred through and the person with the diagnosis comes to us simply to stop the person who's sort of booked the session from nagging them to go into the Qigong session.
Yeah, right.
And then again, it's all about what the person wants. And in this situation, one of the things that becomes really interesting is looking at the mindset. Mm-hmm. So within Qigong, we talk about establishing practices, establishing a regular practice. And the traditional Chinese medicine way of doing it, or the traditional Chinese way of doing it, is saying you must practice for at least 3 hours a day, or you must practice for at least 4 hours a day. Mm. Now, to most people, this is not attainable.
No.
Even if you've got the time, the level of commitment that's needed to do it is quite extraordinary.
Right.
And there's good reason to go there. But actually, what becomes more interesting is looking at what is practice. And so if we come back to this question about somebody who's just come to us because someone's paid for a session and they're just doing it to keep them quiet.
Yeah.
One of the things that becomes really interesting is the relationship with the meds. And if the people are taking meds, what their daily practice of taking the meds is. Because quite often the daily practice will have undercurrents of, it can have very negative undercurrents to it. It could be around the side effects. It could be about the diagnosis. It could be about the prognosis. It could be about any of these.
Mm.
And if we change the relationship with that aspect of the practice of taking meds, we can see very quick results. So even from something as simple as that, right the way through to the full-blown working with people in order for them to purely use Qigong to overcome cancer, there's a wide range of ways that we can approach it.
Right. So do many people in this country look at Qigong as the answer?
I can only really speak from the perspective of the people that we work with. And I'm guessing that over the last 6 or 7 years, we've probably worked with about 100 people. There tends to be 4 or 5 people per year that are regularly practicing with the group. And right. Then other people will come into the retreat work when we're able to run face-to-face retreat.
Right.
And then there are other people who come into one-to-one sessions. So, we do get quite a few, but unfortunately, most people come to us when they've sort of been through the whole piece about Western medicine.
Right.
And then someone turned around and said, sorry, there's nothing else you can do, or we can do for you. At which point, that's the point that people seem to go looking for the alternatives.
Right, yeah. Glad to say that is changing a little bit in our experience. That's how it used to be when we started up Yes to Life. Practically everyone was kind of right at the end of the road and then was looking for a lifesaver. But now we're not surprised that we're the first place that people come to sometimes. So, things have changed in that way. People are much more aware of the fact there are things they can be doing to help themselves, which is good direction from our point of view.
Absolutely, yeah.
Mm. So these people who are looking at Qigong as the answer, they're presumably up for the kind of commitment that you were talking about.
They tend to be, yeah. And I'm going to admit to being slightly dubious about this as a practice. There was a lady I was working with a number of years ago, and she had spent some time with some of the Chinese teachers, and in the matter of about a week, to see the way that she had come on was just mind-blowing.
Mm.
The teachers then went back to China and they asked me to work with her. And so when I went to see her, I asked her what her practice was, what she was being asked to do, just trying to find out, what would be the best way to move forward.
Yeah.
And she said, well, I'm practicing for 3 hours a day.
Yeah.
And so when I dug into it, effectively what she was doing was standing in a lounge in front of a clock and waving her arms and legs around and watching the clock count down for 3 hours.
Right. Okay.
And I just had to ask her, how do you think watching the clock for 3 hours is going to be beneficial to you? And her response was, well, how long should I practice for?
Right.
And my response to that was one breath. Mm. Because to me, if you practice well just for sort of one cycle of the breath, you can get far greater results than watching the clock for 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the question is, well, what after that breath? Well, yeah, take another breath.
Right.
It really, to me, it's about listening to your body. It's not taking the easy option, but it's also not pushing yourself to the point that you're not getting any useful benefit either, because you're just staring at a clock on the wall.
Right.
So, yeah. I would say typically most people would practice for sort of half hour to an hour a day. And then if you've got a significant health condition, I would say quite often you're to put 2 or 3 practices in during the day. And so that can easily take you to 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, can we go back a bit now? Qigong has a long, long history, I believe. Can you tell us about its origins?
I think, well, the history of Qigong, it's so old, it's so sort of tied up in all kinds of stories that it's very difficult to say exactly for certain what happened.
Right.
My understanding is that if you come back into prehistory in China, there was a group of people called the Wu, and the Wu were the shaman of the time, and they were using animal movements. Now, the animal movements, this is something that you see all over the world, and it's really, really logical. If you want to be better at stalking prey, and you imitate an animal that's good at stalking prey, you will get better at stalking prey.
Okay.
You know, if you want to escape more quickly, and you copy an animal that escapes well, you'll learn those techniques. So the idea of animal imitation just makes complete sense to me. But what they were finding was there were health benefits with that. Now, then along came the Yellow Emperor, and this is the moment that I've got to admit that I've forgotten the dates for the Yellow Emperor.
Okay, let you off.
Significantly big. Thank you. It's one of those horrible moments that you're sort of going, no, it's gone. but yeah, when the Yellow Emperor came along, he formalized a lot of the medical practices and a lot of the healing practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so at this point, there was a practice that looks very similar to a number of the Qigong forms that are now used. And it was incorporated into traditional Chinese medicine.
Right, that was documented,
As I understand it, yes.
Yeah.
The earliest documented forms tend to be the I Ching or the Badua, and these have got histories of sort of thousands of years old. But just because it's old doesn't mean that it's relevant to today's society.
True.
And you need to look at what each form is trying to achieve, in my opinion. And so as we sort of came through, after the Yellow Emperor, there was this intriguing piece of time where doctors were only paid when the patient was well.
Right. I've heard of that.
Which is a strange way around. But it meant that practices such as Qigong became mysticized. They became part of the sort of upper echelons of society.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a bit like, I mean, I was involved in the IT world in the late 80s and 90s.
Yeah.
And even at that point, when things were very, very simple, we were always told to make it as complex as possible so that nobody else could, you know, just to make it look clever.
Yeah.
And I can't help feeling the same thing happened around quite a lot of the sort of mysticized practices around traditional Chinese medicine.
Yeah, I think you're onto something.
But then the next thing that happened sort of in the huge scale of things was when the Cultural Revolution occurred. And of course, in this place, what happened was the upper echelons of society were now not considered to be a great place to be.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the practices that were related to them became more difficult in the scenario that was going on in China. And so quite a lot of forms of Qigong appeared at that point to have gone even deeper underground. They became even more mystical, even more secretive.
Right.
But then there were another number of schools, and I couldn't tell you how many, who embraced this idea of Qigong should be for the masses. It shouldn't be mystical. It should be simple. It should be effective. And in many ways, this speaks a lot more clearly to the origins of the practice as well, which is based in simplicity. And so it appears that from the Cultural Revolution, we then got a number of forms of Qigong that came out that started to become more publicly accessible. They became simpler. And this is the Zhenneng form that I practice is one of these forms that's done that. And I think it's really, really freeing, because my initial qualification to teach was in an elemental practice, which is using the same base diagnosis as acupuncture. So you've got to sort of study all of these systems in order to make it work.
Right.
Whereas if you're working with individuals, how many people really want to study that in great detail? You know, you should have something that you can work with anybody. And that's what I find within the Zhenneng practice.
Right. Okay, so there's quite a few different strands of Qigong that you've thrown out names of, which I've never heard of any of them. So there have obviously been lots of different approaches over the years. I mean, how many are current?
It's difficult to say. We are within the UK at the moment. I'm involved in a project called One Qi.
Okay.
And we're trying to get the major sort of influential Qigong practices all together in one place so that we can actually start to have more collaborative conversation and we can accept the fact that all of this goes to the same place. And, you know, one practice isn't necessarily better than another. It's just more relevant for some people than others.
Right.
And at the moment, I'm thinking in the UK, there's probably 20 or 30 different main styles.
Wow.
And some of those are sort of breakaways from other groups. And I think you're probably talking maybe five main styles in the UK. But across the whole of the world, it is thousands of styles of Qigong.
Wow, amazing.
But when you start to compare them, you find that there's an awful lot of similarities between them.
Right.
And so don't be put off by the number that are out there. To me, this is quite powerful because it's the idea that if you go and find a Qigong practitioner and you go, you know what, this isn't for me.
Yeah.
Maybe go and look at another style.
Right, right. Amazing. Sounds like ground for plenty of confusion. And that move of trying to pull all of this fragmentation together, I think Qigong's not the only place it's trying to happen, and it definitely needs to happen. It's like things get more and more complex over time, and actually, in the end, it's not such a help. So, a bit of crossing the barriers between the two different strands, which may feel very different, but to the outsider, they can hardly tell the difference, is a good move.
Yeah.
That thing you mentioned back then about going through that period where the healthcare they were paid, if they kept people well. I mean, that the reason that people have heard of that is because it's come up again as a kind of suggestion as to how you could actually reform our broken healthcare system now.
Yeah, it sort of makes sense, but I'm not sure. I think it creates a whole range of different problems, is my feeling on that.
Okay, you've thought about it, obviously.
One of the biggest issues that I think we have is getting people to take responsibility for their own healthcare or for their own health.
Agreed.
And I think that the NHS, it's a fantastic thing. And being able to receive healthcare free at the point of delivery is such a gift.
Agreed.
But at the same time, it becomes our go-to place. And we also have an attitude that if we go along, somebody will fix us.
Right.
Now, I don't think that changing the payment aspect of this is going to change that base relationship with healthcare. Because I think it may slightly, but to me, the most powerful thing that you can do when you're working with somebody is give them the tools in order to actually take back control of their own health to an extent.
Hmm.
And whether that's the tools to take back control of their health in relation to their interaction with Western medicine or anything else, I think we need to find that space within the healthcare system. Right. And that's what's really going to make the difference.
Hmm. Well, I think governments have begun to realise that's the case. It's slowly trickling in the idea that it's actually good to tell people how to look after themselves, and that if we don't do it soon, we'll all be bankrupt. So, let's hopefully we get to it sooner rather than later.
Mm-hmm.
So, I wonder if you'd fill us in a little on your background, your training experience, and how and where you work.
Oh, right, okay. My stepfather was a minister in the church, and the last thing he said to me before he died was, you need to go and find the thing that works for you.
Okay.
For him, the church was the vehicle that worked for him, but he knew that wasn't going to be something that worked for me. So I started going off and exploring world religions, exploring healing systems, At the time I was working in IT. I had a 25-year career in IT as a finance sort of expert and consultant.
Okay.
And I was sort of fairly new into that at that point. And then along the way, I found somebody who was going to train me in Reiki. And bless him, I walked in to do the Reiki one, and he took one look at me and he said, "You're going to hate this." He said, "You're the type of person who's going to enjoy Qigong." And I think I probably said, "Bless you," because I thought he'd sneeze. I'd never heard of the thing before. But he showed me a little bit of Qigong that he had studied. Yeah. And did my Reiki one.
All right.
And then fairly soon after that, it's one of those things that I'm never sure whether it's weird coincidence or the fact that when you get introduced to something and it piques your interest, you start to notice it.
Yeah.
But there was a Tibetan Buddhist guy who was a Qigong teacher who turned up in Ipswich. And he'd recently come to the West from Tibet.
Right.
And he'd got this astonishing reputation. So I went along to find out what it was about. And I was completely blown away.
Right.
My experience of healing, my experience of doing Reiki and things like this was that the sensations that I got or the experience that I had of it wasn't described by the practice. Something else was going on.
Okay.
And suddenly everything was starting to make sense when I started to look into Qigong. The framework was there to explain my experience, which is always attractive. So I studied a Tibetan Buddhist form for, I don't know, it's probably about 3 or 4 years. But then he didn't come back to the UK anymore. And then I went and studied an elemental practice and qualified to teach in that. And then from there, that didn't quite do it for me.
Okay.
There was something missing. So I went off and I studied another 3 systems, qualified to teach in a couple of those as well. And then I came across the system of Shinen Qigong. And it just ticked all the boxes for me.
Finally got there. Right.
So that was, when was it? 2010, I guess?
Yeah.
That one of the people who I trained with in Qigong, who was a good friend of mine, had got a Chinese Qigong teacher coming over to the UK for the first time. And so Caroline called me and she said, "I'm coming up to see you in a couple of weeks' time and I'm bringing a guest." And I was like, okay.
Right.
That's a slightly strange thing to say. And so Caroline turned up with a guy called Jian Xie. And so my first introduction was actually having one of the Chinese Shining Qigong teachers staying in the house.
Right.
And I hated it. I hold up my hand now and say it was one of the most challenging, one of the most uncomfortable things I'd ever done.
Right. In what way?
It was quite physically uncomfortable to do the practices the way that he was doing them.
Right.
I'd only ever done stuff that had made me feel comfortable before.
Right.
And what became interesting was that actually it was the ability to experience discomfort that was the ability to change. I quite often now when I'm doing training, because I work in corporates and all kinds of places, and describe this thing about the power of a good teacher is in order to create the level of discomfort within the people they're working with that means that they can really question stuff and learn stuff.
Right.
Without elevating it to the point that you're switching off.
Okay.
And most of the Qigong I was practicing at that point was simply in the comfort zone. I wasn't learning anything. I wasn't doing anything.
Right.
It was just nice.
Yeah.
And suddenly something turned up that was challenging.
Mm.
And so, yeah, I grabbed it and went for it. And then Jian Xie came back and stayed again the following year, by which point I was just going, this is it. This is the practice. And I think one of the things that really attracts me to it is the fact that we can take it down to something hugely simple. And we can recognize that there is real power in simplicity. We haven't got to learn huge amounts of theory, massive amounts of movement. You can make a difference with something really, really simple.
That's a great message, isn't it? The last part of that question was how and where you work. So what are you doing now?
Oh, right, okay. I appear to be gaining projects on a monthly basis at the moment, which is slightly perturbing. I've been working under the guise of Energy Play for quite a while. An Energy Play is my local practice. I've got a yurt in the garden that's my studio space, and I do one-to-one and small group sessions with that.
Okay.
But the larger picture, there's also something called Three Monkeys School of Qigong. And the Three Monkeys was set up initially to train people to teach. But what we found was that a number of people who were coming in to train to teach didn't actually want to teach. They just wanted to have the depth of experience that we offer.
Uh-huh.
So very quickly, we started to offer sort of immersive retreats, and they range from weekends up to 15 days and trips out to China and things like that when we're allowed to actually do it, when it's safe to do
yes.
so.
Yes.
But yeah, and so Three Monkeys is probably, I'd say it's the main place that I work through.
Right.
But then, let's say, there's a few other projects around. I've already mentioned One Chi.
Right.
And there's also some work, because of work I've done in corporate in the past, where there's a group in South Africa who are asking me to do training for them, and so that's something else that's coming through. So yeah, it's been interesting. The whole experience of coronavirus and lockdown, and the way that people have embraced the online space,
yeah,
certainly within the realms of Qigong, has made the world a far smaller place.
Yes,
and it's far easier to actually work with a far bigger audience and or a far more diverse audience, I should say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting. All right, so given that there's a broad understanding that we all have now that movement's good for us, and that too much inertia kind of undermines our health, what would you say are the specific aims and intentions of Qigong, and how does it go about achieving them?
I would say it depends on whether you are looking at the traditional styles or the later styles. Within the traditional styles that are very tied into sort of elemental theory, I think probably the first place that people perceive we're going to is an idea of balancing the energies.
Okay.
So within the elemental theory, we have five main energies. So I guess in many ways it's not dissimilar to some of the traditions that we see coming out of India. And so what we try to do is we create balance between them. So if there's an excess in one area, we'll try to draw it round into another or start feeding it from the place before it.
Mm.
And this is the way that traditional Chinese medicine has worked for years. In the Chinese culture, I think it's an incredibly powerful system. But within the Western culture, I feel that we can spend a lot of time feeling out of balance and trying to rebalance. And I'm not sure that that's overly useful for us. I think that one of the messages that exists within this for me is that everything goes in cycles. Mm-hmm. And so our health is something that travels through in cycles as well. Now, the system that I work with doesn't give quite as much attention into the elemental piece. And it sort of looks beyond that. It looks at the idea of what does it look like when everything is simply working well?
Mm-hmm.
And how can we actually access that place? I'm trying to think of a quick way to describe this without using a whiteboard and diagrams and waving my arms around yeah. and stuff like that. And I think probably the way that I describe it is... if you look at the symbol of yin-yang,
right,
the Taiji symbol, quite often what we see is the idea of yin and yang, and the idea of comparison, the black and the white. And this talks about the way that everything gets divided up. So something can't be hot unless there's something cold to compare it to.
Right.
Something can't be good unless there's something bad to compare it to. Now, for me, this is an interesting place, but the thing that's more interesting is the circle that the Tai Chi symbol is contained in.
Mm-hmm.
Because within that circle, there is the potential for anything to happen. This is sort of undifferentiated potential.
Okay.
And this is the place that becomes really interesting within a healing journey. So the reason I say that is that quite often the diagnosis that we have becomes part of the way that we interact with the world. It becomes part of that judgment, the judgment that we have, the way that we interact with others. And this can reinforce the diagnosis.
Okay.
Within the concept of Wuji, or when we go beyond this, we start to look at it as, what would it be like if that wasn't even present? How can we interact based on that? How can we stop reinforcing the idea that things aren't, or that we have this particular diagnosis?
Mm. And just to clarify, so you're talking about acting as if there wasn't a problem?
No, no. Okay. It isn't quite as simple as that.
Okay, I'm glad I asked.
Because the reality is that, stuff happens. I was admitted to hospital earlier in the year with gallstones,
mm-hmm.
That happened. I felt it. But it's how long, or it's what your relationship with that is,
mm-hmm.
that really defines the way that you move forward. And quite often we can hold on to a diagnosis and we can make it a thing for longer than it really needs to be.
Right.
It sort of becomes part of the definition of who we are.
Yeah.
And in that situation, it becomes part of us, and then it's very difficult to move on. What I'm suggesting is that we can be given a diagnosis, we can have an experience of something, we can be with that, but it isn't part of you.
Okay.
That diagnosis is not you. You are more than that. And if you're able to become more than that, then you have a clearer path to actually move through.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, so this is rather more like the relationship to a physical difficulty that a child has, whereby it's all hell while it's, it's just cut the knee, but as soon as it's sort of patched up enough to get on with life, it's straight on and it's forgotten.
In an ideal world, yeah.
Yeah, they leave things behind much easier than an adult would.
Yeah, we do have a tendency to hold on to things. Mm. You know, if you, quite often when you're working with people, you can spot old injuries because they've held on to sort of walking with a stick for longer than they might have done.
Right.
And it creates all kinds of little imbalances in the body. Now, if you can allow yourself to actually hold that more lightly and let go of it, you come back to a far more balanced state far more quickly and far more effectively.
Mm.
And believe me, it's easier said than done. I've been working on this for many years, and it's
right.
It's an ideal,
yeah.
But there's nothing wrong with working towards an ideal.
Not at all. Mm, very interesting. Okay, so apart from the enormous variations in physical ability within the population at large, all age groups, there are specific issues amongst people with cancer that relate to the illness or to the treatment that they could appear to be absolute barriers to any form of exercise at all. Can you talk about Qigong in this context and how it might work for people in these situations?
Could you expand on what situations would be?
Well, there could be post-surgery, someone's had breast surgery, say, or they've had surgery on their abdomen. People who've got lymph problems, people who've had chemotherapy or radiotherapy and they're suffering with chronic fatigue and therefore don't feel they can even get off the bed, this kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. One of the key phrases that we find within the practice of Qigong is Yi Dao Qi Dao. Yi Dao is, Yi is the mind, Dao is the way.
Mm-hmm.
And chi is a horribly mistranslated thing. It gets translated as energy, and it's so much more than energy.
Okay.
I am going to dive down that rabbit hole before I answer this question.
Go on then.
Because I think it's a really important piece. Because if you look at the way that chi sits within the Chinese culture, it means so much more than energy. And the only way that I've really been able to understand it is by looking back at the etymology of the character and the way the character evolved. And so at about 250 BC, the character for Qi was simply three lines. It denoted vapor rising to form clouds.
Okay.
And this sounds mystical and difficult to understand, or difficult to sort of nail down. But what it's really saying is that any invisible force that creates change is categorized as Qi. You can't see the vapor, but you can see the clouds. In the same way as the ocean would be flat calm without wind, you can't see the wind, therefore wind is Qi. You can't see electric running through cables,
right,
but it creates change. Electricity falls into that categorization of Qi.
Okay.
Qi isn't a mystical thing. Qi is a categorization of, it's simply a categorization of invisible forces that create change.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we talk about Yi Dao Qi Dao, what we're saying is where the mind goes, the Qi follows.
Right.
Some people use it as where the mind goes, the Qi flows. But I found so many ways to stop your Qi flowing by thinking things and doing it. So, yeah, the mind guides the Qi. And there's an implication that the power of the mind is actually a very, very powerful thing here. So within this, if you apply it back into Qigong, there's an implication here that waving your arms around is simply a way of guiding Qi. But the mind guides Qi as well. So the way that we create change isn't actually with the arms, it isn't with the legs, it's with the mind. And the movements that we use and the breathing techniques that we use simply guide the mind, because the mind is the most powerful thing that we have. This is what really drives the Qi. So to come back to the question about what can you do when you have limitations of mobility or anything else really, if it's exhaustion or anything like this, it doesn't stop you practicing Qigong. It stops you moving to any great extent.
Mm. Okay.
So then we can either scale the practice back so that we can use a far smaller practice with a similar idea. So there's a practice that's called La Qi, and La Qi is simply expanding out and gathering back. To me, this is one of the most powerful practices that we have within the realms of Qigong. Now, we can do that with the arms, we can do that with the legs, we can take that into sort of full squatting practices and all kinds of extreme movement, but we can simply do it with the breath. We can just watch the breath expanding out and imagine connecting out into the blue sky. And then we can watch the breath drawing back in and imagine the body filling with blue sky.
Hmm.
Doesn't matter whether you're doing the big movement or just the breathing. If you're following the mind in that way, you are doing what I would refer to as Qigong, but many other people would call it mindfulness or yoga or Tai Chi. I mean, even when I used to spend a lot of time cycling,
yeah,
I can see it in cycling. It's just this common thing that if you can train the mind to have that level of focus, you can do amazing things.
Mm. How interesting. Well, what an interesting discussion. It gone to all sorts of places I wasn't anticipating. Look, we're getting towards the end, actually, John. So, look, do you want to just tell me, if I come along to see you and I've decided, right, I want to try some Qigong and I'm actually a cancer patient, what should I expect in terms of what you might offer?
Okay, if you come along to a session, the first thing we're going to do is we're just going to sit and chat about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's about finding something that's relevant for you. There's a number of people who I've worked with over the years who have already got a number of practices. And so in that situation, I wouldn't want to teach you any Qigong.
Okay.
I wouldn't want to teach you any more movement. What I'd like to do is use the conversation about Qigong to help some of your other practices become more focused and to become more effective for you. So it can be that you come along, we have a conversation, we share an idea, and we talk about how that can then translate back into mindfulness practice, or how that can translate back into a yoga practice. It's not that Qigong does it better, it's just that sometimes getting other perspectives really helps you to gain an understanding of your core practice.
Mm.
But if you're coming along to learn Qigong, the chances are that what we're going to do is we're going to have a chat. We're going to do something fun and probably slightly over complex. And then we're going to discover that you don't have to do anything particularly complicated. You haven't got to abide by any of the rules as to how the body should move. We can actually wind it back to something that is going to be deeply transformative for you. And certainly in the one-to-one scenario, I like the idea that you should only really have to work with somebody two or three times, because it's about finding the right idea and the right movement that's going to not only keep them going for the next week, that's going to allow people to sort of move forward and carry on their healing journey. And that could be a practice that's as simple as the Lachi practice that I described, which is just the arms expanding out and gathering back. It could be that it's a walking practice. It could be a squatting form. It could be any kind of really simple movement. Now, if you want to refine that, if you want to find out what happens beyond healing, then there's a whole load of work that we can do there where we can use other forms which can then refine the ability to expand out and gather back. And this is where physical accuracy becomes really interesting.
Right.
But in the first instance, it's about getting body and mind working together in a way that's enjoyable and a way that we trust is deeply effective. Mm. So
that's very clear.
Yeah.
Interesting. All right. Thank you. That's great. Well, look, we are going to have to leave it there. I really enjoyed today's talk, John. Thanks a lot for coming on.
Thank you very much, Robin. I've really enjoyed it.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Do look up John's work, either at his own site, that's energyplay.co.uk, or at 3monkeysqigong.co.uk. That's number 3, monkeys, and qigong is spelled qigong.co.uk. We're very close to Yes to Life's spectacular online event, Your Life and Cancer 2020. There are about 45 top international speakers will lead you through 2 weekends. The first is aimed at those who are new to integrative medicine, and the second at people wanting to find out more. You can find out full details of the extraordinary speakers list and the 2 weekend programs at yourlifeandcancer.com, as well, of course, as book your place at one or both events. Thanks for joining me today to explore the world of Qigong. I'll be back again next week with another interview that I hope you'll enjoy here on the Yes to Life show on UK Health Radio. Goodbye. Thank you.